This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, our General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, I know that you activated your cloaking device, but I can still see you, just barely.
What? This invisibility cloak is awful. Doesn't work at all. I'm sending it back.
Did you get that at the Harry Potter secondhand shop?
Why do you ask?
All right. So, last episode, we were talking about past tense, part one. Today, we're going to talk about past tense, part two. Actually, we're just going to continue our overall discussion of past tense because things bleed back and forth between the two. Matthew, last time we talked about government solutions to problems, and one thing that we mentioned was that maybe the government comes up with a program like they do in this episode where they have sanctuary districts, which become walled areas. And one thing that's interesting is that at the time that this episode was being made, which would have been 1994 because it aired on January 2nd, 1995, the first part did, the mayor of Los Angeles was proposing that the city fence in all the homeless to make the downtown area more attractive to business. This is something that Alexander Siddig talked about in the DS9 Companion. They weren't going to call them sanctuary areas or sanctuary districts, but they were going to call them havens, which sounds very much like the idea here of, hey, we're going to fence you in, but it's because we're making a better place for you.
I mentioned last time that, you know, this is a huge issue in the area in which I live these days, and I can understand the reasoning that a city is trying to go for. If you have a city, like where I live here in the Northwest, I live right across the river from Portland, Oregon, and it is something that is not necessarily your favorite part of visiting a city like that. And there are dangers to it, too. So it's not as though it's just, you know, something about the visuals of the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a massive issue. That, you know, I mean, it's so, and what I mean by massive is it's so much more encompassing, as we talked about last time, too. And the whole idea of how to handle it is crazy because there are no easy answers to this. But I don't think that in any way that would be helpful because I think we would obviously just end up with the problems that we end up with in this two-part episode. And, you know, I mean, it's an interesting thing, too. We've got the sanctuary districts. The United States has a bunch of sanctuary cities these days. I put that in quotations big time because it's just illegal. But, you know, we have all of these things that are happening here in the U.S. and around the world. And it's just so interesting because it one of the things, the hallmarks of Deep Space Nine and one of the strengths of this show is how it has aged so well, in the sense that the issues that it talks about and the way that it talks about them continue to translate to, you know, different time periods. Again, we're 20 years removed from when this episode aired. Everything in it is just as valid now and relevant as it was then, if not more so. And I think when we talk about rip from the headlines, you could be ripping from the headlines now and create a story similar to this on a brand new show. Yeah. You know, I mean, it is eerily scary how close we are to what we are seeing in the episode.
It's going to be interesting here in Tokyo to see what happens as we get closer to 2020, because we have the Olympics coming up, and you talk about the visuals of the city, right? We're going to have all of these tourists coming in from all around the world, and we do have quite a lot of homeless here. And I can remember being in San Francisco, walking down the street and seeing homeless people and having homeless people come up to me, and seeing them happens here too. I don't have as many people coming up, you know, asking for things, but there are a lot of homeless, and there are areas in Tokyo where they tend to congregate, and the government has made some efforts to try to reduce the number of homeless people, and you see fewer of them during the daytime now than you did in the past, but of course at night there are areas where more of them reappear, and some of the areas where they stay are being impacted by construction for the Olympics, which is going to displace these people. And I don't know how they're going to be dealt with, and I think the approach here will be a bit different. We're not going to have sanctuary districts, but that's going to be something that I'll get to see firsthand as we move towards the 2024 of Past Tense, to see what happens in the 2020 of Tokyo. And here I think we have a number of people who are homeless, but they actually do have jobs. They actually do earn income. But as you mentioned in our last discussion, homelessness is very multifaceted. It's not, you know, a simple case of someone being, you know, refusing to work or being part of society. So you can't have a one-size-fits-all solution like a sanctuary district.
And it's the same way as why, you know, kind of having just a blanket welfare system is, you know, the common denominator basist try and fix a solution, and why it doesn't necessarily really help, because each case needs to be dealt with more individually, because each person has a different need and a different, and that's why, again, you know, thinking about what the solution is, you know, it's not just a one size fits all, because that's not how it works. That's not why each one of these people that is in a sanctuary district here on this, in these episodes, they have the scene here where they, Janzia's friend, has helped her get everybody online, and Chris Brimmer, and put these stories so people can see the stories, and each one of them is different. The guy that came to San Francisco to be at work at a brewery, and then there were layoffs because of, you know, machines coming in to do the jobs, you know, and then not being able to find another job. I mean, the stories you hear for each of those different people was fascinating, because some of it reflects where we are today and what's happening today, and the struggle to find work and to do work. You know, it's such a broader topic, because I even think of the idea that we've discounted doing certain types of work, whether it's like a trade. We've made that as like, oh no, you have to go to college, you have to do, you know, like, you put all these ideas into people's heads and made it seem as though if you're a plumber, you're not doing a valid job. But a plumber probably will make more money than I will ever see in my lifetime. You want to know why? Because he's always needed.
Right.
And especially if you're a good one.
Until the robot plumber comes along.
Well, that's, you know, exactly. But, you know, I mean, it just, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's so multi-layered and so multifaceted. The problem isn't just simple. And I think that's something that's really interesting seeing here. And with these districts, like, how do you solve a problem like homelessness? How do you solve a problem like mental health and all of that stuff? We have to find a place to start. And that's, I think, even the hardest part is, like, where do you start?
The stories that are told, you mentioned the one of the brewery and automation causes him to lose his job. And then in this episode, one of the intentions of the Sanctuary District is to help people find new jobs. They have a program for that. But I don't know that that's really the solution, because when you look at today, one of the big issues that is causing a lot of the tribalism and fragmentation in society today is the fact that automation and machines are taking away jobs that were traditionally done by people. And you can make promises that, well, you're going to bring back jobs. But are we going to give up the benefits of automation to our society just to bring back jobs? Of course, I would say no. Once this stuff is set into motion, it's not going to change. And that's only going to get worse and worse. Maybe worse isn't the right word, right? Because we reap great benefit from robots and automation. We have to rethink work, in a sense. We have to rethink education, rethink training. And that doesn't necessarily mean, well, you talk about trade, right? We have this tradition of trades and crafts where you go maybe to a technical college and you learn a trade. It's different than, say, a four-year education, liberal arts education in a university. I mean, you learn different things. You learn important things in both, but you learn different skill sets. And that traditional trade route often did lead to specific types of jobs that, like you said, pay very well because they're very important jobs. And we have gotten away from that a little bit, I feel, maybe a lot. What's the solution to not ending up in that situation in 2024? We're talking about 7 years from now.
I think the thing about that is, one of the things that I see is how far removed we have become from kind of reality. And what I mean by that is the reality of where our food comes from, the reality of how things are made, the reality of what's outside. Like, we have removed ourselves from reality and placed ourselves farther and farther into a make-believe world of digital everything. And that loss of reality is killing the human race. And you can see it here. You know, all the hoity-toity people that Gen Z ends up hanging out with, and they're all dressed in their finest clothes. They're inside. They're in their climate-controlled, you know, like, nothing bothers them because they're in a bubble because they're so far removed from reality. And there's something about being a human being. And, I mean, God, I even felt this growing up. Like, you know, when my parents maybe mow the yard. There is nothing better than the accomplishment, right? Of, like, you look back at that yard and it looks great. There's something about that feeling of accomplishing something as a human being with your own two hands. I built a fort as a kid, you know, in the backyard. I built a treehouse as a kid, you know, and there's because you own it. It's yours. Like, you are connected to the reality of what it is, and it means so much more. And I think all of those things are slowly being lost, and it's something that we kind of, that connection, again, to what I'm saying of reality is, I think, just one of the biggest issues that we have, because people don't even know what food is on their plate anymore or how it got there. Yeah. You know, because it's such an automated process, you know?
Well, Matthew, it was delivered to you in a box and all the portions were predetermined and all you have to do is throw it in the pan.
That's how it works, right? I mean, like,
outside to get it either.
I mean, I could just go to a place where they bring me food that I've ordered off a menu.
Yeah, could do that too. I like that you talked about, you know, building a fort or mowing the lawn, because these are all things that I did as well. I think about, you know, my children how much time. I mean, my children are quite active. They have their extracurricular activities like tennis and ballet and such, but they do spend a lot of time inside. And when I was a kid, I spent all my time outside in the woods, on my bike. I was building a fort. I was just outside all the time, camping almost every weekend. And the world is just so different now. I think it's a good point how we are losing.
Are we those
touch.
Guys that are just like the old men, get off my lawn? That's how we kind of sound right now, Chris.
Except it makes a difference, right, in how you connect with the world and how you see things and how you approach solutions to problems. The fact that the people that we see with Brenner in this episode are very disconnected. Again, this was 1995. I suppose that scene has sort of a late 80s, early 90s feeling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it
to
does,
it.
Yeah.
But it also, I think, works well for today that we do have so many people who are the elites who are making the decisions, and they are so completely disconnected with what's happening in the real world outside of their little bubble.
Well, and it's so interesting too, because, you know, again, they reference the whole idea of student riots, you know, in Europe and those kind of things. And legitimately, in the United States, there are student riots happening on college campuses over what we talked about in our first episode. Aren't essentials. They're not really important things. They're not about learning to do a task,
yes.
You know, or learning to grow as a human being so that you can go out into the world and change it for the better. It's not really about any of that stuff. You know, it's not about providing for the essentials for you to live life. And to be able to help provide for other people to do that too, be a productive member of the society. And it's just so frustrating to see that idea, but it's popping up everywhere because there is a demonstration about everything to the point of where it just goes in one ear and out the other because people are just angry about everything.
That's the problem. And I mentioned last time that I think social media has greatly contributed to the fragmentation in society. And yes, people are ready to be angry about everything to the point where you often don't want to talk about anything. You don't want to say anything because if you do, you're going to be pounced on by a dozen people who are angry about that subject, even though the thing that you've said is completely innocuous. And the thing is that it's so frequent, as you said, it is in one ear and out the other now. And the types of things that people protest about and scream about have weakened the important things. So, you know, everything is not equally important, right? Healthcare, for anyone who needs healthcare, is important. The color of a Starbucks cup is not important, right? These are not equally important, but in social media, they're treated as equally important, and you may have protests and petitions about both.
Right.
If someone wants to make a Star Trek fan film, or if CBS wants to charge you $5 a month to subscribe to their streaming service so you can watch their new series, that's not equal with
outrage.
Whether,
that's wrong.
That's not equal with whether we can pull people who are homeless, people who are in poverty, out of that so that they can have a decent standard of living. And I think that we've muddied the water so much, we've lost our ability to come up with rational and successful solutions to the real problems that we face.
I mean, it's about priorities, right? And we've lost the ability to prioritize what is actually right. important, what's not important. We've lost the ability to even, dare I say it, understand the difference between what's right and what's wrong, what matters, what doesn't matter, what could be done later, what needs to... I mean, there's just this lack of sensibility. There is no sense and sensibility anymore. It's just all nonsense and angry shouting. And that gets us absolutely nowhere.
I wouldn't say it's all nonsense, but the important things get lost in the noise of
right.
the nonsense.
Well, okay, and say even, just think about this. We tend to end up in these problems because we lose the ability to listen to each other, you know, to hear. Yeah. And so, again, we have this happening in our world. We see this happening ripped from the headlines, this idea, like, nobody's hearing what's happening in the sanctuary districts, right? Nobody's listening. Nobody's caring. People have stopped listening. And part of that is when you live in a homogenized world where you only will allow people to talk that you agree with.
Right.
And you won't hear the other, you won't even hear the other side because it might offend you. I mean, that's how you get to a place like this because nobody's hearing. Everybody just has their earmuffs, you know? I mean, it's, these are the things that lead to what we see in past tense. Sadly, yeah. we're experiencing all of them now. And if we don't wake up, if we don't learn to listen, if we don't start to look at the human being across from us or in the street next to us or in the, you know, apartment next to us or the house as just as meaningful of a person and matters just as much as you do, we're goners, you know. The human race could be gone because we just selfish ourselves into extinction.
Yeah. Or at least the society that we have now.
Right, exactly.
Could be gone. Let's talk about BC. He plays a central role in this
episode. Oh, I thought you were like, before Christ. I was like, that's really going back far.
Right, right. We're not that far past tense, but BC in this episode, he plays a central role, as Ira described. He's the overriding theme of the story. The way that they treat him is very Deep Space Nine, and it's very different than how we view things in society today. In the first episode, he kills Gabriel Bell, really for no reason. He's just angry. He steals his food card. And so he's killed the person who is critical to history for American society, for global society, to get through the problems that they're facing in 2024. But in the second episode, he plays an important part. Sisko is Gabriel Bell, has to work with him. And they never mention that BC is a murderer. And Iris said the reason for that is because the point is that society pushed BC into that position, that he would not have been a killer if society had not pushed him into the position that led to him killing Gabriel Bell. He said that if you treat people like animals, they become animals. If BC had not been homeless, what would he have been? We created his backstory, stuff that would never appear on the screen, and decided he probably would have been a garage mechanic or something, even though he's obviously a threatening, scary character and he's on the edge crazy all through both shows. We didn't define him as a murderer. So it's an interesting idea, and I think it's a controversial one, right? Because you could say, well, oh, society pushed me to be homeless, and therefore I ended up killing someone. That sounds like an excuse, but is it an excuse? I mean, there's this anger. We talk about everyone being angry at everything, and I think that the creation of the sanctuary districts is a result of people being angry about everything, because while BC and the people around him might be angry to the point that they are attacking people and they kill Gabriel Bell, the hoity-toity people that we talked about in Brenner's office and the wealthy, they're angry about the people that they see as not contributing to society to the point where they put them all behind the wall. It's not a violent anger, but yet it is that sort of underlying anger that causes people to make decisions and create policies right. that really, really harm others. And they don't think about it because they're not actually using their hands to hurt someone, right?
One of my favorite books on the idea of social justice is called Generous Justice. It's by a guy named Timothy Keller. And he talks about that in the book, this whole idea that what creates these situations are societal, personal, economic. I mean, there's all of these factors that lead somebody into something like this. So you can't just pinpoint it to one. Yes, everybody is responsible for their own actions. We can never take that away. BC here, definitely a murderer and responsible for those actions. But there are plenty of other forces that kind of backed him into the corner, like you said, like a caged animal that felt like he didn't have another option. There were, you can get to that point as a human being where you can't see another way out. And we can put people in those positions when we stop seeing them as people, right? We just see them as a problem. And I think that's a huge danger. You know, when we're talking about this whole idea of tribalism, as we've talked about now for a couple episodes, and segregation and all of these things, when you start to see people as only one thing, you label them this. He's conservative. He's liberal. He's gay. He's straight. You know, she's this. Yeah. He's that. When you label somebody, that immediately puts a framework, a wall around them, which allows you then to rationalize treating them in a certain way. And usually that's treating them as less than human. And therefore, mm-hmm. that's exactly what's happened to people like BC in this episode. That's exactly what's happened to basically people in the sanctuary districts. That's why they have names like Gimmies and Ghosts and Dims. They've put a label now on somebody that just explains away all the problems, as if that person doesn't have a holistic being, that hasn't had dreams, successes, failures, right. Family. I mean, like, it's the destruction of all that is so important about what it means for me as a human being to look at you, Chris, thousands of miles away as another human being, and I see you the way that I see me, which is valuable and important and somebody who is brought together by so many factors, and I need to get to know all of those factors to really know you. BC, nobody has done that for him in years, and he's ended up where he is because people just stopped caring. And it, I think the way that they deal with all of the characters in this show are so fantastic, because they do the same thing with Vinny, the guy who is just the hard nose. I mean, he's really just the hard-ass jerk, right? Throughout most of this, until the very end when his eyes have been opened. Why? Because he's spent time with the people that he is actually truly spent time with the people to get to know them as a human being. And I love, absolutely love the way that they deal with both of those characters, because they're on completely opposite sides, but they're also people who are still very angry.
Yeah.
So it's awesome. Well,
I get the feeling with Vinny that he probably wasn't like that so much before he had this job. And you can imagine that maybe he's been working in the sanctuary district for years and years, and it has created this feeling in him, and he's tired and he's seen it all. And he feels just as hopeless as the people living there. He might be on the side of the authorities, but he doesn't see it going anywhere either. It's just this perpetual state that everyone is in. And he's worn down, and now he has taken on this attitude that we see throughout the episode, but especially when they find Cisco and Bashir at the beginning, and then his sidekick, Bernardo. You can see that he doesn't quite feel that way yet. He's tired, but he talks about, you know, he's got his wife at home, he's got his kids, he just wants to go home and have a hot meal. But you can imagine that 5-10 years later, he might be just like Vinny.
Well, and it's so interesting because the people on the inside and the people on the outside, they have the same issue. They're buying into this labelized humanity where everybody is just a label, right? Like, you're a dim, mm-hmm. you're this, you're I mean, and you therefore treat them like that. And again, instead of seeing you as a holistic person, and it's so interesting because it's not just a problem on the inside. It's not just a problem on the outside. It's both of it together. And how do you change that? I mean, we're talking about changing the hearts and minds of people. And if there's anything harder to change, well, there isn't anything harder to change in this world than the hearts and minds of people to see other people as valuable as they are.
Why do you think it is today that when we look at anger versus reason, when we want to solve a problem like this, we have to find a way to bring anger and reason together? The two characters, BC and Sisko, as Gabriel Bale here, are on those opposite sides. BC is angry. He's just driven by anger. And Sisko, being a Starfleet commander, is driven by reason. Now, of course, Sisko has a bit of anger in him, which bubbles up from time to time throughout the series. And he's certainly able to call upon that when he needs to in order to play the part. So with Gabriel Bale, would we see Sisko lash out in this episode and act angry? He feels that that's what he's supposed to do in order to sell himself as Gabriel Bale. So he's able to pull that up. But really, he's being driven by reason. He's trying to find a solution. He's trying to avoid casualties. He's trying to make sure that history plays out as it's supposed to and that the timeline is corrected. Now, we should remember that Jadzia and Bashir and Sisko, they don't know that the Federation is gone. They don't know that history has been changed. But Sisko still knows that it's important that this event happen as history recorded it, so that the situation for the people in the Sanctuary Districts and for society improves and leads to that future. So he finds a way to make that happen. But throughout, we get anger versus reason, and I don't think we ever get any resolution. This isn't like a TNG-style story where reason wins the day. This, ultimately, I would say, if anything, anger wins the day here, but we still get the outcome that was necessary.
It's interesting because when you think of it just specifically about Sisko, his anger is controlled by his reason. Like when he's angry with Vinny and he pushes up him up against the wall and he's like, you have been a pain in the ass the whole time and do you not realize that I'm trying to keep you alive? That's actually, I think, a breakthrough in their kind of relationship, and Vinny starts to have a turn after that. I think the real issue that you see and through this whole thing is that people don't seem to know how to think anymore. It's just they kind of know what to think. The way to help solve problems is to teach people how to be critically creative, constructively critical. Those are all things that take deductive reasoning, deductive powers, really thinking through an issue, what causes an issue, why it's happening. But instead,
gathering the information necessary to do that as well, not just taking it from one source.
Absolutely. And what today has become, and we've, I think this is what we see in the episode too, it's all about, you know, mantras and slogans, like in all of these social media type, what we would see on social media, hashtag lifestyles, you know, that everything is something you can boil down to 140 characters. Guess what? Life is way bigger than 140 characters, people, and so are the problems in it. And therefore, you can't solve any issue by shouting somebody down in 140 characters. That's not the way to do it. And that's what we see here is the difference between anger and reason. Yeah. Both of them are needed because you need that righteous anger of saying, there's something wrong here. It needs to change. But that anger has to be tempered by the reason of how to constructively get something done. Because otherwise, anger just leads to riots and death. And that's obviously not helpful because that doesn't change anything. It just usually pushes that other side far away from you.
Well, anger moves the needle more quickly and more effectively, right? Reason leads to slower change because you have to have a discussion. So it's much easier to just get indignant about something and, like you said, shout someone down in 140 characters. It's interesting to me how in social media, some things that I say, I will have people shout back at me, and they've defined me by one tiny piece of information that I've consumed. What they don't know about me is that I'm consuming information from dozens and dozens of sources on both sides of the political spectrum, because I need this information in order to understand the issue and figure out not only how I feel about it, but how I feel about the decisions that are being made, the policies that are being set, what might be the best solution, what I should support, what I shouldn't support. Because you're not going to find a solution that perfectly fits your vision, right? Not if you're using reason to come up with a solution to a very complex problem, and anything in society is going to be complex now. So real solutions require cooperation, discussion, negotiation. And that's something that I also feel is quite lacking.
Well, and reason has to be driven by values too. Like, what is it that we value? What is important? How do we even figure that out? You know, all of that takes True. Deductive reasoning. It takes conversation. And like you said, it also takes looking at both sides of every coin. And so if we're just only looking for a solution from one side of the political spectrum or the other, or one side of an issue to the other, we're going to miss a ton of stuff, because not one part of anything is going to have the answers that are required, because the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. That's usually just how it works for the most part. And when we're not even willing to listen to each other, because this episode, it's BC and Vinny, neither one of those people is going to listen to each other, right? They're just angry at each other. They're angry at each other almost for the existence of the other person. That's where it's come to. And it takes somebody like a Bell or Cisco at this in this instance to force them almost to sit down and spend time together and be able to experience each other in a way that's not informed by their preconceptions, so that they can overcome them and then find where they're actually more similar than they thought. And I think that's just so fascinating that this happens in this episode. And that's the kernel of the solution to the problem. It's not government solution. It's really people connecting with other people as people, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think we would all find that we have a lot more in common if we actually talk to each other. You know, people who are on opposite sides would talk to each other. And determining what we believe, our views, our goals is important, but it's also important to be flexible in those, because if you take a stand that's too hardline, then it still leads to problems such as this, because you still ultimately will see another group of people as being less human just because they're not agreeing with your position. But even in this episode, I feel the government doesn't want to talk to its citizens. They finally bring in Detective Preston, and she, you know, is going to negotiate with Cisco as Bell and with Michael Webb, who is the guy who becomes sort of the spokesperson. But it all feels like, I kind of feel like it would in the real world, where it just feels like a lot of lip service. And it is presented like Preston tries to convince the governor of the state to meet their demands. And Michael Webb's stories do sway the public to be a bit more sympathetic towards those people in the sanctuary district. But the general public, they're not the ones who are calling the shots. It would take time for them to influence government policy. You're not going to get a quick and easy solution. And before that can happen, they end up storming the facility. The government takes a violent approach because they can't deal with the protests, which, see, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend like I have an answer to whether or not the riots could have been avoided, the violence of the riots could have been avoided once everything was set in motion. Now, you could say the riots could have been avoided if better policies had been set in the past and people hadn't been pushed into this corner. In the actual moment here, in the Bell riots, well, things had built over time and it erupted, and that happens. But it's such a difficult question of how you would deal with that and how the government would actually end up dealing with that. But I know that what we see in the episode feels very real world. It's not going to get us to Gene Roddenberry's future.
Well, I mean, you have a bureaucratic behemoth coming at a problem. And, you know, when you come at something with a club that needs a scalpel, this is where you're going to end up. And that's the problem with having government solutions to problems most of the time, is they come at it with a 2x4 and, you know, you need a toothpick. And that's just really the crux of the issue. So what it becomes really, I think, is the what I said earlier, it's the kernel of the solution was people seeing people as people and getting to understand them, know where they are. And that's what leads, I think, and that's really what the solution was. That's, it's the thing that moved them forward, because even Sisko talks about the idea that it was Bell's example that led to the change, and it was his story that led to the change. It was that personal connection that people felt to somebody like a Bell. I mean, God, look at just history. Just take Martin Luther King as an example. It was the personal story of people standing up, telling their story to change hearts and minds. It's the same thing that Bell does. And that's the only way to truly make a change, is to find a way to connect with the person across the aisle from you.
Yeah. I thought you were going to start singing some Depeche Mode there for a minute, Matthew. You know, people are people.
Oh, yeah. I could have gone there, but I just like to keep the listeners guessing.
I will say the lyrics to that song fit very, very well.
It's
pretty much
very
everything
true
that we've been talking about. All right. Well, we could keep talking about this for a long time, but let's wrap up with some final thoughts and bring it back to a Star Trek context and, you know, Sisko's solution and, of course, the fact that the timeline is back in order, thank goodness.
Well, I think that one of the things that I like is the conversation that Julian and Sisko have in his quarters on the Defiant, and there's this whole idea of kind of looking back and how people could have let things get so bad. And Sisko's like, I wish I had a good answer. And really, the episode ends so melancholy. But I think that is so important. Yeah. You know, Deep Space Nine is the show that doesn't give you trite, easy answers to problems that don't have trite, easy answers. That's why they're still problems. That's why they continue to be problems, because it's very hard to figure out. I mean, we're talking about the soul of humanity here, and that's not an easy thing to work with, to change, to move forward. And so I really like that. I have to say, what I also really liked about these episodes that we didn't really talk about, but I really liked the character development for Julian. Of, you know, mm-hmm. he's been this wide-eyed, you know, bushy-tailed Starfleet cadet, basically, coming out. He just graduated the academy when he got here. And to see the growth in his character, so that when, you know, Sisko is telling him and Dax, you know, you both need to get out of here. And he says, if it's all the same to you, sir, I'd like to stay because you need the help. And like, just the growth of the character there was just something that was really nice. So even in a couple episodes where they're really doing a ton of social commentary, they're also really servicing their characters very well. And I think that's a huge strength as well of Deep Space Nine, because it's a continuing series. It's a continuing arc. And this was one of those places where I was really watching it again for the billionth time that I've seen these episodes now, and really struck by how much Julian is growing as a character, because, you know, beforehand, he probably wouldn't have done this.
Yeah. That bit with Bashir shows, too, how we forget history because we get so used to things being a certain way. Mm-hmm. In the 24th century, Bashir coming out of Starfleet Academy and having grown up on the Earth of the 24th century doesn't realize that there are those kinds of problems and that there were those kinds of problems. And that's when, as the cliche goes, you know, you're doomed to repeat history.
Absolutely. I was just about to say that. And I think that's when we're thinking about one of the biggest issues here, it's because people forget history. Yeah. Julian is just as guilty of it as the people in the sanctuary districts and who created those sanctuary districts. You've just created a new ghetto. If this does anything and this says anything, it says that it's important for you to know what's happened in the past, or else it'll just happen again, folks. So don't be surprised if it does.
Well, we're seeing a lot of things like that happening in the world right now, which is really quite scary. But this, I would say, as many Star Trek episodes do and Deep Space Nine episodes do, it really stands the test of time. This story in particular is, I think, one of Star Trek's most prophetic, one of DS9's most prophetic episodes. And it's eerie how well it works today, and in some ways better than it did when it was written, which is sad, but it also shows the power of Star Trek and the strength of it if people would only listen to the message. All right. Well, that wraps up our discussion of past tense. Of course, there are tons of things that we could have talked about related to these two episodes that we didn't touch on, and we are well aware of that. But we wanted to focus on this particular aspect of the episode in this discussion. We would love to hear your thoughts, however. So please send us your thoughts on past tense. You can talk to us in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook and it should come right on up. Or send us an email by going to trek.fm/contact and using the form there, choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that'll come to both Matthew and me. You can also go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. That's the word speak, S-P-E-A-K, pipe.com, to send us a voicemail if you'd like. You can record it just using your computer, phone, or tablet, and that'll come to Matthew and me as well. But past tense isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network recently, so here's a quick look at some of our other shows.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
How do they explain McCoy's beard and leisure suit and giant necklace in the motion picture when he first comes aboard the Enterprise? Is that a statement that he was making right there?
It was.
That's the answer.
The statement is,
and what was that statement,
Larry? The statement is that in the future, even rural Georgia can be just as disco as you damn well want to be.
Saturday Morning Trek.
I want to be on the couch of the kid in Maine, and his dad's a whaler, and he knows what ambergris is, and he's watching it Saturday morning, and he turns on Star Trek, and he sees the ambergris, and he's like, Dad, get in here! They're going whaling!
Meta Treks.
But these Romulans are still walking around in those nasty pointy shoulder tunics that they wear. I mean, what's up with that?
Doesn't seem like they shed as much of their identity as the Klingons
did. Yeah, not shedding as much of their identity.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Like, I didn't want to come back to the show after that.
Oh my God. I don't know what's going on here. I don't understand.
The world doesn't make any sense anymore, does it?
Not at all. It makes less sense to me than it did to Rekha Sharma's character at the end of Crossroads Part 2.
And introducing our newest show, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
The key thing with Jetrelli, all of these elements are exactly the same thing as the events in real life. You know, the Metreon Cascade is the bomb. Rhinax is Nagasaki or Hiroshima. You know, the poisoning is analogous to radiation poisoning and all these different things, and the parallels are enormously overt with Jetrell straight away.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere that you get your podcasts, in Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone, Google Play Music, SoundCloud. Go to the website, stream from the show page, download the MP3 file. We try to put our shows everywhere that we can. You can also sample all of these shows in the Trek FM Complete Master Feed, which you'll find in these places as well. That contains every episode of every show that we do. So, Matthew, if people want to find you personally, where should they go?
Well, Chris, you can find me all over the place. I'm on a little place called Twitter, where we do talk in 140 characters. My name is MattRushing02 there. You can also find me on Instagram, where there are very little characters, only pictures. My name there is MRushing. You can find me here on the network doing our General Geek Show, talking about everything that we love in our different fandoms that isn't Star Trek. We need one place on the network where we can talk about those things, and the 602 Club is it. You can also find Star Wars, the 602 Club Collection. Both of those are on Apple Podcasts. Be sure to check them out, rate and review, all that stuff. Make sure you do that. I'm doing a great show with my good friend, Dre Kaufman, called Owl Post, where we talk about Harry Potter. We're just walking through each and every chapter of the series. We finished the first book. We're on to the second now, so join us there. It's so much fun. And then if you're a huge Star Wars fan like I am, be sure to check out Aggressive Negotiations I do with John Mills. And again, you can find both of those on Apple Podcasts or anywhere that you get your podcasts. Now, Chris, I know that I'm not the only one with so much going on, so where can everybody find you?
Well, if you'd like to find me elsewhere on the network, I do one other show. That's The Ready Room, where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series and some other Star Trek news. And I guess I should say all 6 live-action Star Trek series, even though one of them's not here yet. That's Star Trek Discovery. That's what Larry Nemechek and I are talking about on The Ready Room 211, which is the first episode after my return from eye surgery. So check that out if you're interested. And you can also find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. I have my old pieces up there. If you search for my name, C. Brian Jones, and I'm going to have some new pieces coming up soon. Once again, picking up writing as well as podcasting as I try to get back to normal after all of the eye surgery. If you'd like to find me on Twitter, you can find me there and talk to me in 140 characters. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook and pretty much everywhere in social media. And you'll find me in the Babel Conference also. As for the network as a whole, we already mentioned the Babel Conference, which you can find on Facebook. We also have our main page on Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM. And you can find the network on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. If you'd like to help us keep all of this going, we would love to have you join our large group of patrons on patreon.com. Our patrons make it possible for us to produce and distribute our podcasts. We would not be able to do this without their support, and we have a variety of perks for you in exchange for your support, including our special website, Patron Zone, which is available to everyone who is contributing $5 or more per month. You can also contribute less if you like. We're very flexible there on Patreon, and every little bit does help. It does cost quite a bit of money to get these shows out to you. If you'd like to find out how to help the network, just visit patreon.com/TrekFM. That's patreon.com/TrekFM to find out all the details and how to access Patron Zone. I'd like to thank our associate producers here on The Orb, William Murray and Kay Elizabeth Shaw. Thank you so much for your support. And if you'd like to become an associate producer, you can do that again through Patreon. Find out everything at patreon.com/TrekFM. And thank you so much, everyone, for your support. Well, Matthew, it's been great being back on mic. I know I'm personally a bit rusty. I probably sound rusty. I certainly feel rusty, but it was really fun to really get into a serious discussion about Star Trek with you, as we often do here, and talk about 2 of my all-time favorite episodes.
Chris, it was great being back, and we want to thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb. Thank you. Recording.
Yeah. All right. There are so many chroniton particles clinging to my pants that the lower half of my body is apparently 100 years in the past, Matthew.
Awkward.
It's very awkward, right?
Yeah. It's just super awkward.
I think it would be a good premise for a television series, though. You've got a guy who the upper half of his body is in the present and the lower half is 100 years in the past.
How would that even work? I honestly don't know how that works, but...
He's wearing Levi's past tense. Past tense denim from Levi's.
Oh, man. Okay.
Okay. There, got you in the mood for a serious discussion now.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, here we go.